Thank you all so much for coming to Elaine's. My name is Jeffrey Higgins. This is my wife, Cynthia's, in my restaurant. We've turned it into Elaine's Literary Salon. I believe you're the 139th or 140th author I've interviewed since we've opened, so it's really fun. Thank you. And we've made this a home for authors. So if you're an author or you know one, we don't charge. Come on in. And we've created a really nice podcast as well. We think we're number 3 on Spotify, number 4 on Apple Podcasts for literary salons. So we're all things literary in the D.C. area. And this will be a lot of fun, too. So we've
never been called literary.
You suffered over a buck. Trust me, it is literary. So I'm excited about this one. Dr. Joan Nadorf is a board-certified emergency physician with over 30 years of experience practicing in hospitals in Northern Virginia. Her book, Changing How We Think About Difficult Patients, A Guide for Physicians and Healthcare Professionals, was published in 2022 and is widely available in electronic, paperback, and audio formats. In addition, her book reviews and opinion pieces have been widely circulated in both the Washington Post, the DO Magazine, and Doximity. After hours, she likes to travel, read, taste wine. Well, you're in the right place for that. Play tennis, follow Dolly the Poodle, and walk along the Virginia beach. So please welcome Dr. Joan Nadorf. So first off, congratulations on your book. It's a really big deal. It's one of these things where about 80% of people think that they have a book in them and plan to write one, and then when they start and they go, uh-oh, this is kind of hard. Hey, can you guys hear us in the back over there? Is that good? And you can hear us back there? Okay, fantastic. So congratulations.
Thank you.
So when you talk, just talk right in and up into the mic so they can all hear you, because we don't want to miss any of these gems. So let's start with what motivated you to write this book.
When I came out of my residency, long, long time ago, Kathy Kelly, right over here, girl, or there, wherever, and came out of my residency, I started my first job at Alexandria Hospital, now called Inova Alexandria Hospital, and 2 weeks after I started, I turned 30, so it was a long time ago, and it was my dream job. I always wanted to be an emergency physician. You know, when you're a medical student and in your residency, you rotate through different fields, and you have to kind of decide what you want to do. And before that, I thought maybe I wanted to do something else in medicine, but then I discovered emergency medicine. I discovered that is it. It's so wonderful. You get to kind of put together puzzles, figure out what's happening with patients, get to do a lot of procedures in addition to what you think about, and then at the end of your visit, you get to say goodbye to them. And this is like the best thing ever. So what I could not understand was after that experience, and I made it through residency, and it wasn't easy getting into that residency program. I spent 4 years in a residency program. I came out, I got my first job, and I would come home from a lot of shifts unhappy. And I couldn't figure out why. Of course, probably those of you who know me know that maybe it's part of the personality. But I was doing what I really wanted to do, but there was something going on there that was really making me unhappy, and that was dealing with some patients, what I call difficult interactions. The shorthand term we use is my interactions with difficult patients. And everybody who takes care of patients in some way, shape, or form kind of understands what that means. But it's not just patients. I'm sure some of you have students or other clients or people that you work with who you need to continue that relationship with. You can't just say goodbye to them, but something about their behavior makes it really difficult for you. So I decided to research the problem and see if I could figure out a way could kind of understand some of the literature on it. This is what we do in medicine. We do research in that way. I didn't like actually do research and, you know, with patients, but just what was written about it. And I found out there were some things written about it, and I kind of came up with an approach to deal with the problem. And I wrote a lecture about it, and I presented at that time.
This is right after you started, early in your career.
So it was like 1990 or 1991. It gave a grand rounds presentation. At that time, our emergency department was staff. We were part of the faculty at George Washington University, their emergency medicine program. So I gave grand rounds there. with this presentation. The director really loved it. He asked me to give it the next year, which I did, and I tried to incorporate some of those lessons into how I practiced. And then I put it away, and it's so old that it's actually on pin-fed paper. Does anybody remember what pin-fed paper is? Yeah. And I had children. I had 3 children in 2 years, and still working as an emergency physician took a lot of time and energy. And then when I, kind of at the back end, when I was found myself with a little extra time and kind of coming out of emergency medicine, the clinical practice of emergency medicine, I decided I should dig that up and give the lecture again to residents and students, because it's a really, really important message. And it's a message of learning how to accept your patients. And then I kind of learned some new things about how to do that, which I incorporated into the book. So that's the backstory.
No, I love that. It's perfect. So I'm actually curious, because in the book you reference some papers and things, but they're from the 70s. Like, there's some older material. Was that the stuff with just when you first started researching it, but in the interim decades, right, after you wrote this, was there other new research material in this field, or was there much of it?
Well, it's a difficult concept for healthcare professionals to kind of admit that we don't actually like some of our patients. It's not something that you go around talking about. So the first time anyone really talked about it, or the seminal paper on this, was a guy named James Groves. He was a psychiatrist at Massachusetts General Hospital, and he wrote a special article for New England Journal of Medicine. And this is so, you know, in the 25, 30 years after this, people are still referring to that original article, which is called Taking Care of the Hateful Patient. Those are his words, not mine. But there, you know, it was very important to try and, because you know, I think I look at, you know, the way medicine evolved in our country was basically men practicing medicine with this very kind of godlike, paternal, you know, structure. People looked up to their physicians. You did what they said. They took care of everybody like a kindly father. But in reality, physicians and nurses and other healthcare professionals didn't like some of their patients because they were really difficult to deal with. They didn't follow our advice. They didn't take their medicines. They didn't make follow-up appointments, all the things. And so what he did was he kind of broke down into 4 different kind of stereotype categories to help us understand. And what he did and what I kind of have picked up on and wrote about in the book is for us to try to understand our emotions when we're dealing with the patients, and because those give us really useful clues as to what we're dealing with and how we could, the kind of results that we're getting. So his is very much in the realm of more like a psychiatric diagnosis because he was a psychiatrist, but you can easily see how those kind of categories apply across the board.
So when you're having a psychiatrist do this, I mean, you're talking about interpersonal relations, right? So that doesn't necessarily deal with the exact illness or trauma that a patient has suffered. So did like employee assistance program, or did any kind of within the hospitals, does any program address this? Because it seems like that would be something that's like how to make your engine function better, right? To deal with the way that the doctors and nurses and all the, you know, EMTs and everybody are actually dealing with patients.
There are the ways that employers try to deal with this are very kind of results oriented, and almost like they look at almost like as if medicine was like a hospitality industry. You know, we want to try and make people happy, but of course sometimes our patients want things that are bad for them. And we know it, and we have to kind of disappoint them and not give them what they want. But we have to try and make them understand why. So the answer is they are coming at and giving, and there are lists out there how to talk down hostile or aggressive patients. Those are more things to do. My book talks about more ways that you can change the way that you think. Because believe it or not, it sounds, you know, trite, but if you could wiggle your thoughts and get them to a more positive place, your actions and results will naturally follow.
So is it wrong to assume that then, like, hospitals or a lot of medical facilities are more focused on just fixing what they need to fix in order to deliver the service, but they're kind of ignoring the service provider, right? They're ignoring the person who's working with the patient, because a happy employee is going to be a better employee.
You know, our patients are given, like, surveys, after they've left the office, just like, how was your service? Did you get what you want? Again, it's important for us to make them understand that they are getting, like, what they need, which is not necessarily what they want. But I think it's important to address what they want. And I don't know how well people are, how well various businesses and, you know, my experiences in the emergency department, it may be different in people's private offices, how they deal with kind of, you know, making patients' expectations kind of come close to what they're getting.
So these surveys that the administration is doing, are they taking into account that a patient may not know what's right for them and that the doctor or nurse at the time is actually administering some kind of intervention that's necessary?
No.
Oh, good.
No. And I use this example as many of you know, my husband is here. His name is Toby Nadorf. He is a gastroenterologist with Inova. And his company, that company does surveys. Some of the surveys, they actually print people's actual words online. What they're thinking, I don't really understand there. And one patient a few years ago, hope I can say this, Toby, one patient complained that Dr. Nadorf spent too much time with her. Yeah, and thought maybe he was doing that to jack up the bill. So what he does is, he's, okay, John Langan said, were you?
Business strategy, I like it.
Yeah. So, a lot of our, you know, your interaction with a gastroenterologist, you know, a lot of you are preparing for a procedure. So, you know, if you haven't had that procedure yet and you're 50, you need to call him. 45 now.
We'll be doing inspections in the back
here. So you're, you know, you have to take a prep the night before. And there's a certain way that you have to do it.
We don't have to go into the details.
No, we're not going to do it. But
we are a restaurant.
But, you know, we give the, the patients have to have the instructions. Now, you probably can't hear it too many times. But, you know, he makes it a practice to go over them with himself. And I'm sure this lady never had a doctor ever take the time to do it before. And, like, actually put this complaint, and they put it on the website. So just to show you how absurd, you know, that is, that, no, they are not taken into account.
You know, the parallels with writing and reviews really strikes me here, you know, where you can have two readers complain about the same, one complains about it and one loves it, the same exact part of a book. And here you're getting, you know, you're actually spending too much time with me. You're too attentive to my needs. We must stop that. So let me ask you, just on the book itself, how long did it take you to write the book? I'm always curious. It's the first book, right?
This is the first book. Now, I had that lecture, which I kind of call like the skeleton, the bare bones. And I took, you know, almost like a slide or two and made them into chapters and then added chapters. So when I decided to write a book, which, by the way, a friend of mine, I had started writing a few pieces online, and they really liked it and said, well, I think this is what you should do now. You should write a book, which I had never really thought of before. It wasn't like this was an aspiration of mine, although I've always liked writing. So I decided I would write a book, and I decided to write a chapter. I set a goal for myself, kind of like of this focus time, 1 or 2 hours a day. And had a computer, you know, just put the computer was in the kitchen because I had just gotten Dolly, our poodle, who, of course, needed to be near the door so we could take her outside. So it was basically written at the kitchen table. I did about a chapter a week, so there are 17 chapters in the book. So it took me about 4 months of, it was of 2020, from January to March. And yeah, it was, it was actually started before COVID. Of course, you know, one of my kids, you know, celebrated New Year's in Australia and came home with this, you know, had this infection, which laid her out for like a week and a half. I'm like, what? I mean, you know, you're like 27 years old. Why are you so sick? And yeah, COVID. So we, at that time, I had like the first draft. And do you want me to continue with that story about
I'm curious. So, okay. It's interesting because it's kind of different for every author, but it's also, there's a lot of commonality.
This is very interesting or unique story. At this time, I appeared on a podcast, Kevin MD. He does medical podcasts. And before or after, you can talk to the host. It was all remote. And I asked him, well, you wrote a book. How did you do that? He said, well, I have a publisher. I'll send you her name. And, you know, he sent an email and introduced me to her. And she was going to come tonight, but she got a chance to go to the daughter's bachelorette weekend. So I said, that sounds way more fun.
Hey, things are going to get wild tonight. Just hang on there, Joan.
And so I just sent the finished manuscript to her. And, I mean, when I say finished manuscript, I mean, it's like 30,000 words is about 110, 120 pages worth of text. And she, after a month or so, or a couple months of reading it and looking at it, she said, well, I think we need to take the next step. I'm like, what does that mean? She says, well, I'll send you a contract, you know, to publish it. And I'm like, sounds good. So I'm not, like, going to look for other publishers after that. Like, I know a good thing. I'm not the brightest brightest light, but I know a good thing when I see it. And when a publisher, on your first, you know, ask or query, someone comes and said, I'll publish it for you. And what she said was, and it was mostly written for, like, the emergency department milieu, like, as I call my peeps. But she wanted me to expand it to other healthcare professionals and other, you know, parts of the field. And really, you know, all the ideas are the same theories of dealing with, you know, the difficult interactions and patients. So I did that. I did a rewrite, a second draft, and, you know, that whole process and going through the publishing, I say it's like having a baby or two. It takes like, you know, at least 9 months. It took, and it ended up coming out in January of 22.
So how was it coming out with the book? And because it happened to me too during COVID. Was that disappointing because you couldn't do the in-person events, you couldn't do book signings, you know, all that kind of fun stuff?
It was a little disappointing. I feel like, you know, you feel like if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there to hear it, did it really happen? If you publish a book and no one really knows about it, is it really a thing out in the world or making a difference? I mean, and the reason I wrote it is to try and make a difference, to keep young clinicians or older clinicians at the bedside. And, you know, this very vexing part of our practice, the challenging interactions, I feel like we could do so much better with that. And there's so many of our colleagues, especially during COVID, who were, you know, looking for the nearest exit. And rightfully so, things were impossible. But I wanted them to get that message. And a lot of the ways to publicize kind of were not available because of COVID, like, you know, to be doing it in public. I mean, I would have probably had the first big party at our house. So,
you know, you mentioned new employees or veterans with a lot of experience. Who is more open to looking at this? Is someone who's been doing this for a long time open to hearing that maybe I've been thinking about the problem wrong all this time?
I think people in training are a little bit more open to hearing it. or kind of newly out, I think some grizzled veterans probably think, I don't really need to hear this. Of course, I don't think that's true. I think some of grizzled veterans, I'll include myself among them, fall into really, really terrible habits over the years. And we can't even see that some of the things that we think are not the truth. We just think that we're observing reality when really we just have a very judgmental thought about a person or a problem. And, you know, one of the persons who wrote her, one of the things you have to do is get blurbs. Blurbs are what the little things that are like in the front of the book and on like the Amazon review. So, of course, I didn't know anybody. I'm sure you've done this for your books.
Yeah, everyone's forced to do it.
Yeah. And so I had to go to total strangers. And by the way, the people, I did know a few people. Most of those people said, sorry, I'm too busy. And the people who were the kindest were total strangers. Interesting. And one guy said, you know, he said, people ask, I get like 5 of these requests a month or something like that, very kind of dismissive. I'm like, okay, no pressure. You know, if you like it, say something. If you don't, no problem. And he kind of came back and said, you know, I didn't even want to like it, but I loved it. And
how great is that, by the way, when you get somebody like that?
Yeah, and he said, you know, it made me a better doctor, which is like when you, if you have enough humility to realize that and to kind of accept that, you know, new thoughts, that's, you know, what it's all about. So, yeah, I...
Because people get so wedded to their positions, right? Is it, and especially when you talk about somebody who's been in the business for a long time and they're a little jaded and they've been through all this, is there any kind of like magic bullet or some way to make them step back and be able to kind of look objectively at their interactions?
I think that pointing out to them, you know, some of the ways that they're thinking, you know, these are very... They start out, and all of us who are going into this profession, we do it because we really want to help people, we love people, and then when you kind of look at some of your thoughts or saying, or you know, like you, we call someone a name, you know, which is like really mean, and everybody in our workplaces are using those names, so it doesn't even occur to us that not to use those names, and then someone else hears it, or someone says, you really shouldn't, you know, that's a terrible way to refer to another human being. And people are like, yeah, I guess it is.
So how much of that's like a corporate culture, right? That at some point that just becomes normal and people just lose sight of it. Doesn't it sort of slide downhill from that point?
Yeah. I mean, I'm going to, you know, you walk into like a nurse's station and you hear them, you know, I read a lot of stuff online, and they're talking about people say something you didn't know about healthcare, that, like, you know, the nurses or doctors are talking trash about their patients. Mm-hmm. And they're not wrong. They are, but it's one of the ways we're kind of laughing, the way we kind of deal with the stress of the situation. We're not kind of laughing at you, but we're kind of laughing with you, like, can you believe this happened? But we're trying to. I'm trying to steer people away from it.
Well, I mean, it's obviously not like, you know, good behavior, but also it's one of the most stressful jobs on earth, right? You're in an emergency room. Every decision you're making, or most of them, are life and death. And having some black humor or having something to break the tension is kind of understandable in some ways.
One of the it doesn't even start out to be mean spirited, but we just refer to people as their room number. You know, because we don't have the time to, like, learn people's names. In fact, we don't even want to call people by their names because you're in this public setting and there are HIPAA violations, so you don't want to, you know, say, you know, there's Mrs. Callahan. You say, like, the lady in bed 10. And, or even kind of worse is you'll say, well, the sickler or the cancer patient or something like that. So it's very dehumanizing. We fall into these traps because, you know, like, just everybody just uses this terminology. To us, it doesn't even seem bad. I know that, you know, when you're not in the profession, it probably isn't like, how could you say that doesn't sound bad? Of course it sounds bad. Toby says in his profession, the people who, Terry's a nurse anesthetist. You know, we need for people to not eat anything before their procedures. So of course they get hungry, and they come and they say, "Well, I took the prep, but I ate." They call them eaters. Yeah, I mean, you can't have a procedure for one thing. You know, they get very angry. This, you know, it's a problem. You know, they're difficult. They get very angry, but you know, they're at risk to aspirate. You know, we don't want the food going in their lungs. And then on the back end, you know, it has to be clean down there for them to see anything. Okay. And if there's stuff in the way, they can't see anything. Right. So then you have a procedure that isn't useful.
You know, it strikes me a couple of things. Like, isn't one of it part of, like, efficiency? You know, you're talking about a room number. Now we all know who you're talking about. Like, here you would talk about a table number, right?
Exactly.
Even if you know the person, you're sending them to the right place so there's no confusion. And isn't there a part of it that that's sort of self-defense on the side of the healthcare worker where you maybe don't want to humanize too much because you want to keep that professional distance?
That's true. I think it is the challenge in each of us. We want to view our patients as real people, as people who remind us of our grandmother or our neighbor or our friend. But when we feel those connections, when there's a bad outcome, and invariably there's going to be a bad outcome, you know, everyone is going to die at some time or another, and one of us, or emergency department, or some physician or nurse is going to be the person taking care of that person. And sometimes, you know, being the right person to shepherd someone through that part of life is what we're being asked to do. So, what I advise for people to do as part of the book is to just allow yourself to feel those emotions. Sometimes you want to feel sad. Some horribly sad things happen in our profession. I mean, you probably, you know, the latest TV show has some of these things in there. All those things are taken from real life. Every single one of us has worked in an emergency department has heard what we call the scream. The scream is, you know, a parent who's just been told that they've lost their child. And we just know what that means. And it's horrible. And, you know, I had many times, I'm sure Lydia has, Kathy Kelly, many times had to go in and tell parents. I mean, I tell people that grandparents have passed, and then we also have to tell parents that children have passed. And it's
That's
one
brutal.
Of the most difficult parts of our job.
I can imagine. So getting into the content of your book here, so like what percentage of patients do people in the medical profession consider difficult?
You know, when they actually done some research on this in a, like an internal medicine practice, 10 to 15% of patients are difficult. I think an emergency department probably a little bit higher. But so, you know, if you're seeing 20 patients in a day, which like in a busy emergency department, you would, you know, that might be like 4 or 5 people that are really, you know, if you had your druthers, you wish they weren't there. But you have to deal with them.
I mean, it seems like in an emergency department where almost by definition, things have happened in an unexpected way, right? It's not a long-term care plan, that the tensions would be incredibly high, and that it would sort of breed that where people are in shock and people are in trauma. It seems like, you know, if there's any break in like the psychological fabric there, it's going to happen in when you're in an emergency department. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with these situations. I talk about the kind of stresses that the patients are under. They have no idea what's happening to them. They maybe have done a quick search online, and have, you know, the first 4 things that they read are horrible. So they're always worried they're going to die, like or die right away. I mean, everybody's going to die eventually, but we don't want them to die right away.
Don't get all technical with us here.
So there's a lot of stress. They're worried about, and they're comparing it to other experiences that they've had. Some people have had terrible traumatic experiences in medicine, what we kind of call medical PTSD. And to be fair, we treated children back in the day very badly. We didn't think that they needed anesthesia. We didn't think they needed enough pain relief. So we have this one of the beginning of the book, I talk about the factors on the patient's side that we have to consider that are kind of bringing them, why they're not being ideal in their interactions with us.
Well, so how are they characterized as difficult, and what is the behavior they're exhibiting that puts them in this category?
There's a pretty wide range. For some are angry and aggressive. I mean, unfortunately, a lot of emergency department patients are violent when they don't get what they want. And they are, on a lower level, they're frustrated or angry. They're non-compliant or they're not adherent to the plan. We've asked them to do something or go somewhere, and they don't do it. Or to wear a splint, or to use crutches. We give people these instructions for a reason. And if they can't, we don't want you to put weight on, your ankle or your broken leg or something. If you do it, you're making it worse and not better. So these are the type of behaviors that we're kind of categorizing as difficult or difficult interactions. And for those of you dealing with children, not so much with the patients themselves, but the parents. And sometimes the parents, in their zeal to do what's best for their children, are not doing what we ask them to do, have some kind of unrealistic expectations about what they can get or how quickly they can be seen.
Are healthcare providers using like heuristics when they go in there? Like, is there a certain behavior that they see and it's like flipping a switch and now that person's in the difficult category?
Absolutely. Well, heuristics are kind of like little cheat codes, and Jerome Groopman wrote a book called How Doctors Think and talked about heuristics. And when we see difficult behavior, we definitely kind of get our guard up and think a certain way. And it's probably not as charitable as we would like. Yeah, that is true. And some practices actually red flag. I spoke to a lady I know who is an OBGYN, practices in D.C. She's retired now, but she said in her practice, this is when they had paper charts, they used to put those little green dots, like the little tags. That would tell anybody who picked up that chart that this is a difficult patient. And
There's a Seinfeld episode about that. Have you ever seen it?
There's a Seinfeld episode where Elaine looks at her chart and sees that she's been labeled as a difficult patient. And then they show the doctor, as soon as he sees it, he basically like closes the chart and walks away and doesn't listen to her anymore. So, of course, she wants to put Kramer on the job to go back in and steal the chart so he can change it. So it's pretty funny. But so it's, this is a real problem. People, even on comedy shows, they're...
So part of your book is trying to explain to medical professionals what's happening here, right, and make them look at these interactions in a different way. So what are some of the things that the patient is feeling and that's driving this behavior that maybe the medical provider needs to take into account when they're having an interaction?
Well, this is a big part of what I'm trying to tell people. Usually the reason that people are not following instructions or are unable to follow the instructions, either they can't afford a medicine, don't have transportation to get to a follow-up appointment, they have some other obligation like picking up a child or taking care of a grandchild that prevents them from showing up for a dialysis appointment or something like that. So instead of what I'm trying to tell people to do, instead of just labeling them non-compliant, which is really kind of a bad thing to put on someone's chart, but it gets put on there all the time, that people should lean in and try to find out why. Now, for busy docs and nurses, they can't always do that, but we do have resources to help people, like with prescriptions or with transportation. But if we don't even know what the problems are, we can't put people together with the resources. So
for everybody who's been in like an emergency room and the chaos that's happening and the people coming in on a Friday night or something, how realistic is that for the healthcare provider to try to, they have a difficult patient who's resisting and causing problems, to really stop? And let me dig down and find out why you just threw a specimen at me.
Okay, not very. However, there are ways to not escalate. And then the problem, you know, so I have seen this. People come in hot, aggressive. Our natural tendency is to get our back up and to be defensive, which is, you know, like the second act of war. And what we really need to do is step back quiet, to not mirror their emotions. I call it mirroring emotions. One of the things that the healthcare professionals do, it's a evolutionary thing. We mirror the emotions of our parents, but when our patients come in angry and hostile, it's very important that we don't act the same way. But every single one of us, and I'm gonna raise my hand here, has probably found ourselves yelling at a patient. And when it's almost, you have to kind of like, okay, I just heard that. I got to step back, you know, bring it down. One of my colleagues, when I was working at Fort Belvoir, got so angry at something going on in a room, he went in and put a patient in a chokehold. Yeah, I mean, that...
Which page of the manual is that?
Yeah, that was not, and he was taken out by the military police. That was terrible. But just to show you how kind of triggering the whole thing was, and like, for him, it's like, I don't know what he was thinking, but he went off.
Is there any kind of in-service training where like doctors and nurses are told like de-escalation tactics, like lowering their voice and, you know, letting people vent and those types of things?
Yes, there are, and those are kind of like, you know, in the book I talk about the think, feel, act cycle, about changing your thoughts so that you can. Your emotions are a little bit better, and then that what you do or don't do follows from that. So those kind of lists come from just the do part, which is good. It's good to do, but it would help if you kind of get yourself to a better part of understanding and curiosity. So that's what I talk about.
So I'm interested, in the book you talk about like doctors sabotaging themselves with this mindset a little bit. So how is it, obviously it's bad for the interaction, but how is it bad for the medical professional?
Well, what's bad for the professionals is that at the end of the day you feel terrible. And you feel like maybe I made a mistake spending the last 12 years of my life training to be a physician. And there are a lot of parts of our profession that might make you feel that way. But like, again, I said, on this part, we could do a lot better. So we don't, you know, most of us started, we filled out those applications for PT school, Madison's a PT, and nurse anesthetist. We filled out those forms and applications because we wanted to help people, and we want to, you know, help people feel better. So to get to the point where we actually hate people, you know, that's a very sobering thought, and most of us don't want to be that way. At the end of the day, we don't want to come home and feel terrible. I mean, this is what I'm trying to get people to remember. 15 or 16 people were happy, or at least they were satisfied. And you know, and it, when you're dealing with kids, if you do the right thing and have given them the proper dose of acetaminophen or ibuprofen or something, you actually get a smile at the end, which is like magical. So you want to remember those feelings are happening and kind of diminish the feelings of the interactions that went poorly. So it's a given that some of the interactions are going to go poorly. I'm not telling you that you can get rid of all of them, but my goal is to make people realize, okay, that was only one or two out of your shift, so it's not that terrible.
So there's a lot of like efficacy in cognitive behavioral therapies, and like a big step in that is understanding what the problem is to begin with. Have you found that like writing a book like this or doing your lectures, just making the people that you're lecturing to aware of this somehow can maybe make them stop or take a pause when they're kind of going sliding down that hill?
Yeah,
before they choke somebody out.
So these ideas are really borrowed from cognitive behavioral therapy. And if you can, if you realize that every patient that walks in through the door is this kind of event or circumstances that is absolutely neutral, and by that I mean there's nothing going on there until a doctor or nurse or physical therapist or counselor has a thought about the person, okay? So now, like most of, a lot of us will agree when we see something terrible that we have certain thoughts, like it's very sad that something happened to someone, isn't that unfortunate? But, you know, people have different thoughts about the same people, and we can nudge our thoughts in a more, and think with more intention about some of our patients, even some of the return patients who we see a lot, who come in with the same problem, and try to be, if we have more charitable thoughts towards them, we can kind of put the pause there and say, what would I like to be thinking about them? And then we can, you know, view them with more curiosity and more empathy.
So, I mean, this seems very common sense in a lot of ways. So how do you get this message out to people in the medical profession? Like, have you... Do you have hospitals that are interested? Do you have universities? Like, what have you done to try to get this out, and where has it been received?
It's hard to get it out. I don't have a academic position, so I don't have that advantage. I have myself and my mouth, and putting out there on social media. The people who, when you get to a certain age like I am, the people who I went to med school with are people who are like deans of universities and or emergency medicine programs. And so I've tried to reach out to those people. At the beginning, when the book came out, I tried to send out to people electronic copies to people who I thought would have some influence. I'm going to get around to a few things that I've spoken at, like just a couple of weeks ago. So I sent a book to a guy. He was resident in New York at Maimonides Medical Center. This was during COVID, and he loved the book. He told me he would read a chapter of it before every one of his shifts. He found it, like, inspirational. I call it, like, self-help. And he said, would you be willing to come and speak? Someday I'll find out about it. So this, like, almost 4 years later, I got an email from, this is through my webpage. She said, can you come? She's a medical education resident at Maimonides Medical Center in New York City, okay, in Brooklyn. And she says, can you come and speak to us? We don't have any money to pay people for things like this. I'm like, okay, I'm going to come do it anyway, because my daughter has an apartment in Manhattan and I can stay over. And get a train. I took the subway over to Brooklyn, and I spoke to them, about 40 or 50 residents. They seemed to really like it. I think that this dovetails into what you said before. I think that residents are just coming out and not having a little bit of this cognitive dissonance. What they thought they really wanted, which was a career in medicine, and then when they get there, they're not that happy. It's not what they thought it was going to be. People don't want to take our advice. I mean, you know, like, I just studied for 8 years and you don't care what I say. Yeah, that's happening. And so they need a little reality shakeup, and I need to kind of explain to them what is happening and how they could make that aspect better for themselves. So I spoke there about a year and a half ago. Keck, which is the medical school, University of Southern California, invited me to come and talk, do a grand rounds there. I was very excited about that. I have spoken at continuing medical education conferences. I'm trying to get the word out there. Anybody?
Children's Hospital of West
Chester. Right. Thanks, Leah. A children's hospital in, where was it? It was in New York. It was at Westchester. They asked me to come speak to the staff there. Someone, I don't know, it's really hard to know how people get a hold of your book and they reach out through the website. A local doctor, I thought she might come tonight. She asked me to come speak to the residents at Walter Reed, and then she asked me to come speak to the faculty there, which I did. So when people see it and ask, I'm willing to come. So if anyone knows anybody or thinks, you know, I'm willing to do online things and also in person.
Are you offering like consulting services? Because it seems like this is sort of a win for everybody, right? The hospital can avoid some liability. They can make their staff happier, a better customer experience. I mean, the whole thing. And you know, you could offer this to them. Is it, or are they just not buying into it? Like they don't want to spend the money or the time because they think things are working as is.
Well, the book is actually published by American Association for Physician Leadership, so theoretically, it's kind of being pitched to people who are in leadership positions in hospitals, people who are like chief medical officers, I was hoping there would be a little bit more from that outreach, but I think I think this is true for authors. So much of publicity and marketing is kind of from your own experience and putting yourself out there. And basically, I'm shy, so
it's a little bit of a struggle.
It's a little bit of a struggle, but I'm working on it.
Well, you're doing great with
this.
So I'm going to go around and we'll take some questions. But first, I just wanted to ask you, like, what was the most surprising part of this whole thing? Because everybody has an idea of what the whole process of writing a book and getting out there is. Was there anything that really kind of surprised you, whether it was something that was harder or easier?
It was a little surprising that it kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, fell into my lap without working that hard to get it. And, you know, what I hear from other authors is that they're, like, pitching their ideas and trying to get an agent. And people come to me, actually, almost like an expert, and I'm kind of, like, mentoring people, which is kind of, like, breaks my brain a little bit. And I'm happy to give advice. I don't know what it's worth. But a little bit of the advice is just about writing and trying and going to various, you know, just be willing to keep on asking people. So I think people have come to me and asked for advice. I also, one of the other little gigs I have is that I review books for the DO magazine, which is written for, you know, osteopathic physicians. And so a lot of people have written books and want me to review their books. So I have had to read some not so great books. I have read some wonderful books for that column, and if anybody needs some recommendations on various books, I'd be happy to give them. But so I have some sense of what is good and what is not so good, at least what I enjoy to read.
Do you have a website where
Dr. Joan Nadorf.
And do you put up book recommendations on that? It's not a bad idea, because sometimes you do that for other authors, and a reader certainly want that, but then they can do it for you as well.
Well, I do. There's a blog on there. It's called After Emergency Medicine. I also post the blogs some other places, medium.com, sometimes just on LinkedIn, if it's kind of something that I think belongs on LinkedIn, because I do some travel stuff. But I do all the book reviews on there, too, because, you know, I think it helps. I know that there's a doctor in Michigan. He wrote a book called Autism Revealed. It's a pretty dense book, but I think, you know, I'd really like to help him get the book out there. And I read it. It's hard to read. You know, like it's not something like a novel that you pick up. But for someone who needs, like, a reference in that category, it's useful. The magazine didn't want to publish it, so I'm just putting it out on my own website, and I'm going to hopefully just put it on his Amazon page. The reviews are really helpful, I think. I've asked a lot of people to write reviews, and a lot of people have been kind enough to do it.
Oh, that's great. All right, if you would stay here, and I'm going to walk around, and if anybody has questions, just raise your hand, and I'll ask you to speak right into the microphone, and this little one, too, so it comes out on our recording.
Hi. I was wondering if your lectures have changed at all with the internet being bigger and people doing, like, Dr. Google more, with, like, coming into the ER or to whatever healthcare provider, being like, well, I have these symptoms and Google says I should do this, so why are you not doing it?
So one of the ideas I'm tossing, the question was, you know, have things changed because people are Googling their symptoms? And of course the answer is yes. Not so much in this book. I mean, it doesn't probably make some people more challenging when they only want to hear what they, you know, they think that, you know, their 20 minutes of a Google search might equal my 12 years of training, but it's not a thing. But, you know, I think what I tell people, I'm glad that people look things up. And I'm writing some information for people, perhaps the next book, about how to be a smarter patient. And there's a certain way to kind of bring up that up, like, not, I don't think any doctor wants to be upstaged by said, I think I have this. Just like, oh, well, I'm a little concerned that I might have this diagnosis. I can remember back in the day, if you're old enough to remember what a newspaper is, a patient I was seeing at the hospital, he had a very bad headache. And he told me he was concerned that he had temporal arteritis. Temporal arteritis is like a vasculitis, an inflammation of the veins over here in the temporal area. Very severe pain. Well, he was sitting there reading the Washington Post. And I said, well, I assure you, if you had that problem, you would not feel like reading the newspaper. So, but it's good that people, because you know what? You have to address what people's questions are. Because sometimes the questions are in left field. I probably would have seen that guy and gone through the workup for, you know, a headache and would have never said to him, I don't think you have temporal arteritis, which are like the words he wanted to hear. And I would have never thought that because it wasn't part of my differential. Probably should have been, but, you know, I don't remember exactly what I was thinking. But, you know, people come out with some crazy stuff. One of the stories I used to tell that is I saw a child, which, you know, in retrospect, this sounds kind of weird, but he had a little burn on the tip of his penis. He was like a two-year-old. Some boiling water flopped over like someone cooking rice and was almost nothing. It was like, it looked like the head of a, like a little eraser tip, little red spot. And I asked the father any questions, you know, before he was leaving, everything was good, we're sending him home. He said, yeah. I said, oh, what? He said, can he be a father? I didn't think of that. I'm like, oh, yeah, it won't be a problem.
You have other questions on this side?
Hi. Thanks for doing this tonight. I've been excited to see it for the last few years. I'm her daughter, for those of you I haven't met. What was the most difficult part of writing the book?
Don't say me.
The most difficult part of writing the book, hands down, was having to provide the author headshot. Okay? This, if you know me, you know that this is kind of how it looks, and it doesn't really get much better. It gets worse. And, you know, I'm not about, like, makeup and hair and all that stuff. So she says, you know, the first thing she wants is an author headshot. Kathy Weisblatt, who was here a few minutes ago, one of her friends is a photographer and does, you know, a lot of, she comes in and does the shots, like, outside, so you have natural lighting and takes lots of shots. So I had to, this is what I went through to get the author headshot. I went to Sephora and said to them, teach me how to put on makeup. and sell me some makeup, which I did. And I put, and because I wasn't going right to the headshot, she had to teach me. And believe me, I only learned about 10 minutes of the hour session that we had. And it, you know. And I went to the hair salon, which is like right around the corner here, Aquilano. And I had her do my hair. And I think that was maybe the day before, so I could just do it. And I had to wear something, which I thought would be, you know, kind of complimentary. Went to the backyard. It was a nice day. And we got the shots, a lot of shots. Even some of, there's one cute little shot with Dolly, the poodle. Yeah, we got something usable. But that was way harder than writing the book.
Other questions here?
Joan, in thinking about patients' self-realization in their interaction with a patient that will precipitate what they feel and think and do, is the remote visit that physicians now are adopting increasingly going to hinder that self-realization about their response to a patient in terms of how they're going to think and feel and do, or not?
Well, I think it will. This is my friend John Symington, who's an amazing physician, probably never met a difficult patient, and I admire people like that. I'm not saying he has them, but he finds them, something interesting about them. You know, I think it's a really important part of telehealth, but I think that the physical exam is so important. And, you know, you have to, that sort of interaction between the professionals and our patient takes such an important part in person. And for physicians to touch their patients is really important. The first thing I always would do when I would come into the patient's room would be to grab their hand, which they probably thought I was shaking their hand, which I kind of was, but I was like feeling their pulse. And because you learn a lot from that, like, you know, like if they're sweaty, if they've got a normal pulse, and if they're not, you know, some arrhythmia or whatever for our profession is really important. So I think it's going to have a negative effect. Do I think, you know, it's almost what I tell, and my friend Kathy Kelly is doing some telehealth now. It's almost being used as the first triage layer to get you to where you're supposed to be. So that's what I think.
Okay. So you have some books up here for sale, is that right?
Well, there are a few. There aren't very many, so... if anyone needs them and we run out, I can figure out a way to get to you. This book is available online. It's available electronically, as a Kindle version. People like to read it that way. It's available as an audiobook.
Do you read it?
I did not read it. So those of you who know me can imagine my voice, but as you, if you've figured out, I'm from New Jersey, and I have a strong New Jersey accent, and we decided we needed a professional.
It's incredibly hard to read a book. It's a whole performance.
Yeah. No, I love audiobooks, and I knew that it would be a bad idea, and narrated by a female doctor, you know, because I made a conscious decision to make all the pronouns, the physician pronouns, she. And like, why not? It's my book. So
what is your website again?
DrJoanNaidorf.com. It's DrJoanNaidorf.com.
All right, wonderful. So I have two requests for everybody here or who are watching this. If you could go on Amazon and just leave her a review, it takes like 30 seconds, and it makes a really big difference just to get some visibility for the book and trigger those Amazon algorithms. And my second thing is, if you like what we're doing here at Elaine's Literary Salon, if you could jump on Google or any of the sites, Open Table, where you rate restaurants, and leave us a nice review, we'd really appreciate it. So you'll be signing books up here?
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you. Well, Doctor, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.